months old. I'm not quite sure whether it's still new, but until it's 3 months, we'll keep saying Happy New Year. It's nice to see everybody back alive, energetic, and what we are going to do, because we have decided as a committee to have this workshop. And this workshop is not a workshop for the sake of a workshop. It's also influenced by a number of processes and challenges that are happening within the labor sector, which are not things that are new, we all know. But as we once said when we came here, I said on behalf of the committee that labor is about law. Finish and done. Law. If you think that you are going to find a shortcut, I'm not going to be able to do that. It's law. That's why when we, some of us, when we fought that there should be all these acts that are governing this sector, it was a conscious decision. Because we were governed, we were supervised, we were trained by a system that didn't respect law at the time. But we're holding this workshop at a very exciting month. I was telling my colleague as we were coming that when Matiba was released that day, we were on our way to work. We came late. One day that we came late, and we tell our supervisors, "Hi, why do you want us to explain? Don't you know what is happening in the world and in the country?" It was just we were, I don't know how to say chaos. It was exciting because there was a revolutionary song that we used to sing that day, that those years, that every saying got 4 o'clock, every saying Matiba. And it was, I still remember in my main road, it was packed. But what has come to my mind today is that when we were in a strike in PE, was a national strike of Nehau at the time. Very difficult strike. We then got a message that Matiba and leading the delegation of the African National Congress went to our leaders and asked a question that, what is it that you think we can do better? You know, as shop stewards, we then said, not even shop stewards, but members said, well, if then they go to our offices and our mayor, it was the house that, I think so in Boko, they were visiting all those offices. So it shows that they do have an interest of resolving our problem. And when we then said, Honorable Mugabe, as social to our members, is that not, are we not then, we're proposing as social that let's tell our leaders that we are proposing that the strike must be called off because a president of the African National Congress and that of the country. It was a very, I don't want to say an ugly strike, in the health sector in particular. And we were berserk when we wanted the Basic Labor Relations Act conditions. I'm reminded of marches that were around the country, PE in particular in Eastern Cape. So all that were about our endeavor to say workers do have rights. And there's a challenging issue now, I would say a challenging issue that is coming in Advocate Bono that says rights goes with responsibility. Now when you say that now, I'm always reminded by those that were young at the time, but now they are still in the workforce. Then when I ask them, but why are you doing this? Is there any better way? There are acts now that are assisting. Oh, Uchongok Suslinden, because we are on the other side. We were led by some of you in disrupting work. But it was, we were learning at that time. So this workshop is a workshop that is then going to, because now we are in a different environment, different space, but that does not take away the fact that workers have got rights. And ours is to ensure that we empower them to understand that, yes, it is in the Constitution that they've got a right to strike. But in doing that, there are steps. There was one area that I liked, the unprotected strike. I remember when Avril Bono, that says we can go to an unprotected strike if we are agitated or what by the employer. So I liked that. Because when the employer, and we're very clever, we could say, but they're very afraid of us, and they are. So when we, and then we go out, and when we are told that, well, you're going to be charged, why do you take workers to an unprotected? I said, no, it's you. You have agitated us. But I think at an appropriate time when we are there, we are then going to be taken through on, as lawmakers, when we are faced with that situation, what to do. We have got the responsibility of leading, and the department has also got that responsibility of ensuring that we understand. I once said, Advocate Paul, in the last term, when there was a board of one of the entities of the Department of Health. So labor, the department came in with an amendment of taking out labor in the board. And then said, oh, so why? No, because this is a technical board. I said, no, let me remind you. At a particular time, when National Health Laboratory Services was called South African Medical Research Council, I hope some of you will remember that. It was labor. I know for a fact because I was in the leadership of NEHAO at the time. It was labor that was in the forefront of ensuring that now it's what is called. And if you are taking it out because you are assuming that workers I'm not technically sharp. You are going to have a problem. Or I hope, and I say it, I said I'm saying it without any favor or fear, I hope you are not afraid of labor. Because if you are afraid of labor, I'm not talking about now, I'm not advocating for. If you're just afraid of the threat called labor, there's going to be no stability in the workplace. What is important is your ability to sit down and talk and understand. When we came back the following day and put back labor rep in the pot. So this department and this committee has got that responsibility of ensuring that right across in all workplaces, in all the departments, how do managers and public representatives and workers understand well, and business understand that laws are here to be adhered to. Let's sit down and talk, but what is important is that people, we are not to talk out of common sense. We must understand that this is what is to be done. I'm welcoming you, 2020. Those one translation will translate within the context of how then do we ensure that when we finish our term, hoping that we'll finish our term as this group, we leave a legacy. We're proud that our people understand their rights and also that rights goes with responsibility. I'm still sick, but the whole December I was a patient. I think I managed to rest. So when you see me lifting up my arm, don't think that I'm doing something strange. I'm exercising. I was done a shoulder operation last year. Somebody said that goes with age. I said, well, I don't know. We'll see. So, good people, we are not in any meeting that is going to need people to vote. So we are free. Let's just be listening to people that have got expertise. We are to learn from one another and empower one another. And presenters will then have to understand that they are also learning. No, they're not going to speak above our heads. What is important is respect and discipline. Well, workshops are not like portfolio committees, that if somebody does something wrong, called to order and is shown the door. But if a need arises, then the chair will take over to ensure that there is utmost discipline. Having said that, we have got a couple of apologies. The minister is out of the country. The deputy minister is representing the minister in the cabinet meeting. Honorable Nontsele is in another meeting. He will join us tomorrow. Well, I don't know, later. Okay. And the arrangements, flights have been cancelled. They will arrive tomorrow. Honorable Bagram will join us tomorrow. And researcher Deboho is off sick until Tuesday. Until Thursday. Now we are then going to do the house rules. Our phones are on silent. I'm not quite sure then in the workshop, but my understanding is that it's workshop of the honorable members. So it will be honorable members that will be interacting in the department. But those that are not in that category during break can ask questions and whatever. So we're going to introductions. I'm Lindela Dunja, chairperson of the Portfolio Committee on Health. On my right is Mr. Zonani Sakasa, who is the Secretariat to the committee, Mr. Dodo, who's assisting Poshia, who's our assistant committee secretary. I will then allow honorable members to introduce themselves. Then I will then after that, before the department, or after the department, I will then introduce our guest who is to take us through. Over to you, honorable members. You are so stiff. So stiff. You are from holiday. So stiff. Honorable members, over to you.
My apologies, Chairperson. One is still in a holiday mood. Greetings to the members, the guests, and the officials. My name is Honorable Ngaban from the African National Congress. I thank you.
Good morning, everyone. Compliments of the season. My name is Honorable Louise Denner from the Freedom Front Plus.
Sanibona ekuseni, sihlale ngiyaxolisa ngokufika late. Ngungowesixolane wenkatha. Ngiyabonga. Good morning everyone, and welcome everybody to the beginning of the year. And I enjoyed everyone and had a very marvelous festive season and festive mood, so am I. My name is Nceba Inana from the Democratic Alliance. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Sibusiso. Welcome, Mdabe, from the African National Congress.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Michael Carter. I'm from the Democratic Alliance.
The other apology that I received was that of the DG. I don't know who's leading the department. Mr. Moroto. Okay. All right, over to you, sir. Your team.
And good morning, honorable members. We're also looking forward to the workshop, and we are hoping that after this workshop, we will be able to clarify a number of aspects, and maybe also, I like the part when you touched on the historical context, because all our laws are anchored on the ILO conventions, and as we present them, hopefully we'll get to understand each other much better. And the fortunate thing is that most of them, once like other departments, takes a shortcut. At the most, it takes us 4 to 5 years because you have to go to cabinet, public comments, and then go to NEDLAC, extensive negotiations, and then finally yourselves, all the hearings are held, will also last. With me, honorable members, is a team of CEOs who tried by all means to restrict the numbers to 1% per division, so as to make sure that we also manage the cost, but to make sure that you get as much as information as you need from us. I'll ask members to, that is the different leaders of the divisions, to introduce themselves. My name again is Sam Rodova. I'm responsible for public employment services.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Greetings, Honorable Members, colleagues. Greetings of the new decade. My name is Eki Muilwa. I'm the Deputy DG responsible for Inspections and Enforcement Services in the Department.
Good morning, Honorable Chairperson and members and colleagues. My name is Bahumi. I'm the DDG Corporate Services in the Department of Employment and Labour.
Good morning, Chair, and good morning, Honourable Members and my colleagues. My name is Deboho Marubin, the UIF Commissioner. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, Honourable Members, colleagues. My name is Tando. My surname is Wababa. I am the Parliamentary Officer in the Office of the Minister of Employment and Labour. Thank you.
Good morning, members. My name is Deboho Tejani. I'm the departmental spokesperson of the Department of Employment and Labour. Thank you.
Good morning, Chairperson, honorable members, my leadership. My name is Pindiwe Boko. I'm from the DM's office.
Greetings, Chair, honorable members, colleagues. I'm Zandi Mwenge.
Good morning, Chairperson, members of Parliament. My name is Nolukolo Sigaba. I am from the Office of the Chief Operations Officer in the Department of Employment and Labour.
Good morning, Chair and honorable members. My name is Peggy Maduna, the CFO of the Department of Labour.
Good morning, Chair, and good morning, honorable members. My name is Vuyo Mafata, from the Compensation Fund.
Good morning, Chair, honorable members. I'm Albert Brink. I'm the Cape Regional Manager for Productivity SA.
Good morning, honorable members and colleagues. I'm Dr. Nandi Dabula from Productivity SA. I'm representing Mr. Motiba, who is the Chief Executive Officer, who is not here today.
Good morning, honorable members. Cameron Solomon Rajan, CCMA Director.
Good morning, honourable members, Chair, honourable members and colleagues. My name is Virgil Seafield, responsible for labour policy and industrial relations in the Department of Labour.
Good morning, Chair and honourable members and my colleagues. My name is Matapela Matabuhe from the Office of the DG.
Honourable Chairperson and members, Professor Singh flew in this morning. She will be joining us during this morning. She will be dealing with the board advisory related matters, but she's on her way.
There's one entity that has not represented.
The acting CEO will be here tomorrow. I'm also the acting CEO of Supported Employment Enterprises.
Well, thank you very much. As you are sitting down, Honorable Member, we will humbly request that you introduce yourself.
Morning, Honorable Chair, our guest, Honorable Members, Kingusibongile Zuma from the ANC.
Everybody is going to introduce himself and herself. So can we, you tell us your name, your surname, and which institution or company you are coming from?
Good morning, Chair, Honourable Members and officials from the Department. My name is Marco Schmidt. I'm the Parliamentary Liaison Officer for the German Consulate General at Cape Town, working for the Embassy in Pretoria.
And the ladies behind you?
Morning, Honourable Members. My name is Mucha Muchemwa. I'm from PMG.
Haneen Davis from PMG.
Emily Orion, also from PMG.
My name is Monique Cry, and I'm also from PMG.
We have been joined by our media, our communications officer of Spongile, the one with the register. So, PMG has got an interest today. The whole army is here today. Very interesting, eh? Well, as I will be vacating my chair, because this is the workshop, let me introduce to you a person who's going to facilitate, that's the correct word, this workshop for us. It's somebody who grew up under me. He was my neighbor. We were neighbors in a street called Grattan. For those who don't know PE, so you can go to Mr. Google and check. And please, I must not be accused of what you call nepotism. So I'm so excited that, you know, you and he happens to be my son's friend, so I don't know how do you call it, but because he then took a conscious decision of empowering himself as he grew up, he's called an advocate. Professor of Labor Law at Nelson Mandela University, a chairperson of the Essential Services Committee, and his name is Advocate Lufuyo Bono. So I don't think he is a stranger to, he may be a stranger to us in terms of the committee, but for those that are coming back, like or maybe they've met, otherwise we have invited him to, we thought that he will be, because of his experience, he will then be able to assist us to really understand what is it that we are doing and what is it that we are to do and what is it that we are not to do and what is it that we must not be afraid to do. Over to you, Advocate. I'm going to come that side. Mm-hmm.
Honorable Chair, Honorable Members, Heads of Entities in the Department, good morning and welcome to this workshop. You've already been welcomed, so I'm going to hit the road running. We're going to start off, and I think it sets the scene perfectly with Mr. Virgil Seafield, with the labor laws housed in the Department of Employment and Labor. So, Virgil, if I can just hand over to you. May I make a request that whilst the presentation is being conducted, that we note our questions and we'll take the discussion once we're done, unless the presenter prefers otherwise, then you can just indicate. Over to you, Virgil.
Thank you. Members and Chair, what I will try and present is and the task that I was given was to just give an indication of what the labor laws are. So I will deal with them at a high level, and probably just talk to the objectives of the legislation rather than the content thereof, so that we can deal with that at that higher level. My apologies, I have a frog in my throat. Secondly, from the outset...
I don't know what is the thing of other members. I will highly appreciate Advocate Bono that... personally, I have problems with presentations that are of the high level. It must be explained. Not because we don't know, but because assist us to. Maybe the high level is the language, which because at times it, not unless we are trying not to take much time, but you'll bear with us if in you dealing with your high level presentation there'll be times where we say, no, can you simplify? Because not all of us are law funded. I thought I must say that is fine.
Thanks, Chair. I think I'm sure Virgil will cover the detail, and in the process of questions, we'll try and dig deep into the detail. Thanks, Virgil.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. Let me also just indicate that as I've indicated, Chair, it will be high level to the extent that it won't deal with all of the detail there, but it will try and seek and address the majority and the purpose of the Act as we go forward. Technology seems to fail me, Chair, so let me move. Mr. Moran Yani in relationship to the CCMA, the two commissioners that are here will deal with the detail around those pieces of legislation, because they deal specifically with the legislation and independently with those pieces of legislation as we go along. So there are 9 pieces fundamental of the legislation that we administer. It's the Labour Relations Act, which forms, in a sense, the bedrock of our labour regime in the country. The Basic Conditions of Employment Act, which sets conditions of employment. The National Minimum Wage. And incidentally, Chair, I do talk fast, so if I go too fast, please slow me down. Just indicate the National Minimum Wage, that establish a National Minimum Wage, a floor under which nobody should be paid. The Employment Equity Act, the Employment Services Act, the Unemployment Insurance Act. In addition to that, we have a Money Act, the Unemployment Insurance Contributions Act, which is fundamentally Department of Labor legislation, but it's actually a money act, so it is administered by Treasury, if you will. Then we have the Occupational Health and Safety Act and the Compensation for Occupational and Diseases, Injuries and Diseases Act, the COIDA Act that we have. These are the pieces of legislation fundamentally that we deal with in the Department of Labor. So as I've indicated, the Labor Relations Act forms the bedrock of our legislation. It sets a process where there is essentially a process of voluntary compliance, if you will, that is permeated throughout our pieces of legislation, apart from one or two legislations where compliance or non-compliance is criminalized in relationship to our legislation, but we'll deal with those areas as we go along. It was promulgated in 1996. There were a few amendments to the Labor Relations Act, but crucially, what I must indicate is that, and Mr. Mortova has started addressing this, that the Labor Relations Act is a product of social dialogue. It's a product of social dialogue that's gone through the phases of social dialogue in NEDLAC, here in Parliament, etc. And the social dialogue in relationship to the Labor Relations Act, not only in relationship to organized business, organized labor, but organized community, was part of the process in developing the Labor Relations Act and its amendment as we go forward. The objectives of the Act, Chair, is in effect to give effect and regulate the rights endorsed by Section 23 of the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa, which fundamentally states that everybody has a right to fair labor practices, etc. That's the one part. The second part is to give effect to our obligations to the International Labour Organization. Now, a number of conventions that have been developed by the ILO has been embodied in our legislation. It is given to effect in our legislation, whether it's about national minimum wage, whether it's about collective bargaining, whether it's about the right to strike. These pieces of legislation gives effect to our commitment that we've made in terms of the International Labour Organization. But it also provides a framework in which the respective unions and employee organizations can engage in collective bargaining and formulate industrial policy. And fundamentally, it provides an orderly basis for collective bargaining. The labor leader, my apologies. It deals with the adversarial labour market. You would recall that at some point we in this committee indicated to the to its members that our labour market is very adversarial. To the effect that, for example, the caseload in the CCMA. Now, I'm not quite sure whether the result of the adversarial nature, but the caseload in the CCMA is the highest caseload across the world. In one organisation, I think on a yearly basis, they deal with plus minus 150. 160,000 instances of adversarialism, if you will. So our labor relations environment is very adversarial, and it deals with that adversarial nature of the labor market, both in the bargaining council, the CCMA, as well as in the labor court. What it also does is it entrenches the right of freedom of association and the right to belong to any trade union or employees organization, and form that employees' organization or trade union. And it provides that organizational rights for trade unions. It gives the same rights, if you will, to bargaining councils,
And it shares a basic architecture and the same core functions and common objectives that are set within the Labor Relations Act. It seeks to democratize the workplace by creating an environment where employers and trade unions can collectively bargain about conditions of employment, wages, and conditions that are appropriate for the sector, as well as dealing with their labor disputes effectively by promoting centralized collective bargaining. What it also does is codify the dismissal procedures, which is fundamentally the ambit of the TCMA, and introduces a labor court that replaces, in a sense, the old, and I've used the word ineffective, but the industrial courts that we've had in the past. That fundamentally deals with the scope of the Labor Relations Act. The detail thereof is what the Act specifies and sets out. The second area of work that we are responsible is in our legislation and the Basic Conditions of Employment Act was first promulgated in 1997. It has been amended a few times. And what it does, it did was essentially repeal the old Basic Conditions of Employment Act of 1983, which, to a large extent, the 1983 Act, which to a large extent provided conditions of employment for white workers and not for black workers, if you understand the history that we're going to. It's a product, again, as I indicated by Nedlet, again of social dialogue, and I think it's important that we stress this at every point that we go. So that legislation that comes to this house has been engaged upon through social dialogue. Incidentally, Che, the constituency of Nedlec at this point is asking for a much more involved relationship between this committee and Nedlec, so that the work that is done at Nedlec finds the resonance here in this house as well. Apart from just providing a report of Nedlec to this house, it gives effect to Basic Conditions of Employment Act. Gives effect to right fair labor practices, which is set out in Section 23(1) of the Constitution. Provides for the regulation of basic conditions of employment. These are hours of work, leave. It talks about rest periods, etc. So the whole arrangement of working time is encapsulated within the Basic Conditions of Employment Act on a number of levels that you have. I spoke about sick leave, I spoke about annual leave, I spoke about family responsibility leave, and it gives effect to all of these kinds of conditions that are set as a flow of rights that no one should be, unless there's a bargaining council, which cannot vary the conditions lower to what is set in the Basic Conditions of Employment Act. It also provides you for the instance of variation change, where an employer cannot, for example, afford a minimum wage or a wage. The Basic Conditions of Employment Act sets a variation process that will allow the employer to apply for variation, even if it's minimum wage, but there's conditions of employment as well. For example, hours of work. If I need to work instead of the 45 hours, I need to work, for example, 60 hours of work. The Basic Conditions of Employment Act allows you for that variation as well. It impacted upon the lives of about 6 million workers in South Africa. So it's huge. If you look at the labor market, where there's only about 10 million workers in the labor market, the Basic Conditions directly impacts about 6 million workers. In addition to that, we have had sectoral determinations that are still in force, which impacts on about another 5 million workers, give and take a few in the country. And it is fundamentally there to deal with those unorganized and vulnerable workers that you were. This Basic Conditions of Employment Act allowed us for the first instance in South Africa to set conditions of employment for farm workers, for domestic workers, for private security workers. These are contained in sectoral determinations that are still in force for those kinds of workers that we have. So the purpose of the basic conditions of employment, and if I give you an overview, it is provide that immediate protection for those vulnerable workers, such as part-time workers, farm and domestic workers, as indicated. It wanted to address the issue of poverty and employment. It regulates the and prohibits the child labor. Now, I'm saying that advisedly, it regulates and prohibits because there are instances where children can work, for example, in the advertising industry. Therefore, we have a system that allows for, it would be, and I always use this example, it would be if you want to advertise baby Pampers. It's going to be difficult to use an adult to advertise baby Pampers. So it acknowledges that effect and it allows for children to work in that industry, and it provides for a system that allows for that. It, as I've indicated, sets a minimum floor of conditions of employment, but also to allow that through collective bargaining you can vary those conditions of employment. I've spoken about individual contracts, I've spoken about sectoral determination, and I've also spoken about determinations that have been made, ministerial determinations that have been made in relationship to the basic conditions of employment. If an example of ministerial determination is a ministerial determination on small business that covers a whole range of small business, and it varies about four conditions in that ministerial determination. It, for example, varies leave period. It would be difficult for a small business owner that employs one or two people to apply the legislation in the basic conditions of employment in its totality. It regulates out, and it regulates leave, for example, in a ministerial determination for small business, recognizing the need for small business as the engine of employment growth, of economic growth in the country. So there is a ministerial determination for small business. There are areas in the industry that can't comply with the basic conditions of employment. If I look for example, in the private security sector chain, the private security sector is a 24-hour operation, 365 days a week. It would be senseless for me to have a private security company at my premises or at my house for 8 hours, and then thereafter, because the basic conditions of employment exist, you can't work for more than 8 hours. Why would I have a private security sector? So it allows for a sectoral determination that sets specific conditions, taking into consideration the peculiarities of the sector for its operation. So it allows for that. It allows, for example, for the taxi industry to be able to operate long distance and short distance in relationship to the hours of work. It allows, for example, for farm workers, and it allows, for example, for construction workers in the incidence of inclement weather to be able to deal with those conditions. Because these workers are at the behest of the environmental factors. So if it rains and I come to work as a construction worker, the employer must pay me for those periods. But if the employer could foresee that there is going to be rain, as an example, the sectoral determination makes provision for that reality. I've spoken about the issue of children performing arts. I've spoken about the issue of learnerships that we have, where we set remuneration for those in learnership, and an expanded public works program, that the EPWP program, where we have sectoral determinations that deal with the peculiarities of that sector that we have sectoral determinations for. These are all pieces. These sectoral determinations are basically basic conditions for those sectors, and it's a reflection of the basic conditions of employment, but adapted to those sectors. And then it sets wages. And it has other conditions that we also have. We have provident funds. For example, in the private security sector, in the contract cleaning sector, we've established a provident fund in those sectors. There's, for example, bonuses in the private security sector, which the Basic Conditions of Employment Act does not deal with per se. But because of the agreements that have been reached within those sectors, we include those within the sectoral determination because it talks to the peculiarities that I've indicated of those sectors. The national minimum wage is a new product of this house, and it actually sets a national minimum wage. Now, perhaps there's a fallacy that says that domestic workers and farm workers and EPWP workers are not covered by these the national minimum wage. But this house decided, as an example, that because of the impact on employment, the impact on the ability to employ workers, these wages will be differentiated from the 20 rand an hour that the current national minimum wage says. Given the status where they are, that they were at that point in time. It provides for a basis to review that national minimum wage. It sets the National Minimum Wage Commission that on the basis of facts and research will be able to advise the minister on a national minimum wage. If the national minimum wage needs to be reviewed upward or retained at that point in time, research will indicate what the conditions are that informs whether there is a review of the national minimum wage, either at the lateral level, keeping it at that, increasing it, or in fact, we've crafted it such that we actually allow for the national minimum wage, which probably would never happen, but to be lowered, if you will. This national minimum wage, as I've indicated, covered about 6 million workers. Now, let me just make a critical point. This is the first piece of legislation that works away, that moves away from the notion of employees, and it covers workers in the industry. So, for example, where you have an employee, you probably have a relationship between an employer and his or her workers. In instances of workers, more broadly, you have, for example, the person that comes to your house to wash your car, which is not your employee, but he works for you. And therefore, this minimum wage covers that kind of reality as well. So that we provide for a national minimum wage in for workers in this regard. The Employment Equity Act, colleagues and honourable members, is the next piece of legislation that I want to address. Its purpose is very clear. We come from a history where there was unfair treatment of people in the country, but what it wants to do is promote equal opportunity and fair treatment in employment through the elimination of unfair discrimination and implement affirmative action measures to redress the disadvantages in employment experienced by designated groups. The Act also provides, for example, equal pay for work of equal value. It's a new concept that has been developed by the ILO, which we've embodied in our legislation. It established a Commission for Employment Equity, and their mandate is to advise the Minister of Labour on, for example, code of good practice, regulations, and policy, and other matters as it relates to the Employment Equity Act. You will recall, members, that you considered the amendments to the Employment Equity Act for two fundamental things, I think. One is to set targets for industry-wide targets, and the second one is to deal with the issue of companies that do business with the state in relationship to its compliance with the Employment Equity Act and broader labor legislation. The amendments to the Employment Equity Act, for example, say you can't do business with the state if you don't comply with the labor legislation. You can't do business with the state if you don't have an employment equity plan, as an example. You would also note that the report of the Commission on Employment Equity has, over the last number of years since its inception, has indicated the lethargic move towards redress. And I deliberately call it a lethargic move towards redress because we've seen some changes at different levels. But at top management, for example, we have not seen. At middle management, we've seen a change. In the public service, we've seen a change. But in the private sector, the change is minimal, to say the least. And it deals with a number of issues. It, for example, deals with the code of good practice on HIV and AIDS in the world. It provides technical assistance guidelines. It deals with the issue of people with disabilities, and it's technical assistance guidelines, which in short we call them tags. It also deals with the integration of employment equity into HR policies, handling of sexual harassment cases. I've indicated the equal pay for equal work of equal value, and the preparation of the employment equity plan. So that's sort of the broad framework in which the Employment Equity Act is ensconced in. since August 2015 saw the introduction of the Employment Services Act. In fact, coming into the operation of the Employment Services Act. Again, as I've indicated, and I'm probably going to say this ad nauseum, that it was a product of NEDLAC. And I'm deliberate about this project. It provides for schemes to assist employees in distressed companies to retain employment, to facilitate the employment of foreign nationals in a manner that is consistent with the objects of the Act and the Immigration Act, provides for the regulation and registration of private employment agencies, establishes the Employment Services Board, establishes the Productivity South Africa, provides for the establishment of supported employment enterprises. Now, these factories were there. This actually regularized the existence of these factories within the Department of Employment and Labour. And to provide for transitional provisions and matters concerned with the factors that I've raised. It requires the department to provide specific public service employment services, including, for example, matching and placing with work seekers with employment available working opportunities. It says, for example, that each private employment agency, the Kelly, as an example, as a private employment agent, should be registered with the department. There are two pieces of legislation that set the social security floor for the department, for South Africa. The Unemployment Insurance Act and the Compensation for Occupational Injuries and Diseases Act in South Africa. What I'm going to deal with now is the UI Act and the UI Contributions Act. The UI Contributions Act I'm not going to deal with specifically because, as I've indicated, this is a money legislation. It, for example, provides for the establishment of the insurance fund to collect unemployment levies and to pay out claims to unemployed persons in the event of unemployment. That's fundamental for various reasons for unemployment, whether you're on maternity, whether you are sick, etc., whether you've been dismissed. And it applies to all employees and employers. An employee who has been employed by that employer for less than 24 hours a month and his employer, so it covers that whole spectrum of employees. So this notion of that you are employed for less than 24 hours is dealt with and it provides for that separation, if you will, distinction. The only distinction is if you're employed for less than 24 hours a month. Otherwise, all employees are covered in terms of this legislation. Even if you're under learnership, in terms of the Skills Development Act, and employees in national and provincial spheres of government to our offices or employees as defined in the Public Service Act and the employers, and it also covers an employee and his or her employee when that employee is in the Republic for the purpose of carrying out the contract of service, etc. So if on termination of that relationship, of that contract, the employer is required by law and by the contract of service, apprenticeship or learnership, and any other agreement to repatriate that person or is that person required to leave the Republic. The Occupational Health and Safety Act seeks to protect the, and my apologies, I see there's a spilling error there, the well-being of workers, both in relationship to injuries and diseases in the workplace, and the hazards that arise therefrom. It's in a sense a proactive attempt by the government to prevent and avoid work-related injuries and illnesses. You would also recall that there is an amendment to the Occupational Health and Safety Act, which we are currently busy with, and hopefully it will be finalized shortly. And it cuts across all of the industries in South Africa. It even applies to those people that come into contact with that workplace, even if that work individual is not an employer at that specific point in time. For example, if there's a construction work happening, the wall falls down on a passerby, that person is covered by the occupational health and safety. The last piece of legislation that I want to deal with is the COIDA Act. And it provides fundamentally and basically for compensation for disablement caused by occupational injuries and diseases sustained through or contracted by employees in the course of their employment, or their deaths resulting from such injuries or diseases. Employers are required to submit a return of earnings on an annual basis. I think I've covered all the pieces of legislation. I've dealt with the high-level issues that are addressed, and I've tried to deal with some specificities, but that's what, the core of legislation that we deal with. Thank you, Chief.
Thanks, Virgil. I just open up for questions, clarities, and comments. Yes, sir.
Thanks, Chair. Two questions. The first is that, I mean, a suggestion has been put forward from different quarters for a very long time that South Africa's labour legislation environment is too onerous and that there need to be amendments and deregulations and a loosening of the labour market in law and regulation. I'm referring particularly to the National Minimum Wage Act, and I wanted to ask you, when was the last time that the department did a comprehensive impact assessment of all of these laws housed within the department and what effect they are actually having on the state of employment in South Africa, and whether there are any plans in place to perhaps revisit some of the legislation currently governing our labour framework? And then secondly, in terms of the National Minimum Wage Act of 2018, you mentioned in your presentation that the National Minimum Wage Commission would annually review the national minimum wage level. What is the latest development on that score? Has a decision been taken by the Commission to increase the national minimum wage, and if so, by what amount? Allied to that question, has any impact assessment been done of the implementation of the national minimum wage on levels of employment? In other words, has the introduction of the national minimum wage in any way contributed to increasing levels of unemployment in South Africa?
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. One, just on curiosity side, is it acceptable in South Africa that kids are to be used for child labor? I'm raising that because you have raised the issue of the advertising industry. Is there any way that we can then say, no, this is to be what? Looked at, reviewed. So that's why the question is, is it, we have just taken that as something that is to be done. I just want to on a different way rephrase the question that has been asked by Honourable. I'll ask the same question but in a different way. Yeah, let me not say rephrasing it. My understanding is that there is a commission that was assigned to look on the impact and whatever in terms of the of the minimum wage. How far is that as the department? Because all of us were concerned, we're asking these questions because we have, is there any way that maybe by this year we will get that report? Because it is that report, in my understanding, that then will address this, because those were, if I can say, terms of reference given to that commission too. So as the department can say, what, how far then are you? The last one is, maybe it's an unfair question because it's supposed to be really a, you know, the learnership area, if I can say it. It's an area that is those young people are left on their own to navigate, survival. And I get a sense that some of them are being, should I say, abused or taken an advantage of. How do you think that should it be the responsibility of unions, or should it be also the responsibility of labor through its inspection entity, inspection and enforcement? Those would be my three.
Thanks, Chair. Can I deal with these two and just note the three? I'll come back to him. Otherwise, we'll have too many questions for Virgil to answer. Virgil?
Thank you, Chair. There are fundamentally two questions that I needed to address. The one is the issue, and the issue around leadership, allow Sam to deal with the issue about leadership. Mr. Mortova to deal with that. So as I've indicated, the national minimum wage, and I'll deal with that one first before I go to the broader question about the onerous nature of our legislation. Let me deal with that, the impact of our legislation on employment, and the Department of Labor has done some research through the DPRU in relationship to the impact of legislation on the effect of it on the, so we've gone beyond just the effect on employment. It's also on the effect on the alleviation of poverty, the cost of living, etc. So that we have a broader picture in relationship to the impact of legislation on employment, etc. So there's been a report done. It's not a new report, but I think there's some space for us to go back in relationship to the impact on the impact specifically on the national minimum wage. The National Minimum Wage Commission is currently in the process of doing research on the impact of the national minimum wage on employment and as I said, the broader issues that comes with the cost of living, the ability of the employer to get out his business, the effect it would have on the creation and retention of employment opportunities, the effect it would have on the on living standards of workers that is covered by the National Minimum Wage. So there's this broad report that is in the process of being concluded. We had wanted to use the latest information available from State South Africa, but because of the sensitivity of that information, the report can't be released right now. Before that, the quarterly labor force survey latest report is released by Stats South Africa before we jump the gun for Stats South Africa. So there is a report being done in relationship to the national movement, both at an empirical level. So for example, we're looking at the numbers of its impact on conditions of employment and its broad numbers, but also in relationship to the lived experience of workers with the national minimum wage that we have. Does it have any impact, a negative impact on employment? The current report, and that report will come to this
the results, but I can just indicate that the current report says that there's a marginal impact on employment in terms of, as with any national minimum wage that is implemented in different countries, it's agnostic in relation to the different sectors and its impact is different on different sectors that we have. So, for example, it won't have the same impact that it will have on farm workers and domestic workers, etc., but because it covers the broader economy in the country. And it wants to address those specificities within the economy so that we have a clearer picture of the impact on the national minimum wage that we have in the country. The report, for example, indicates that there is no impact or very little impact on the agricultural work, the sector, on negative impact on agricultural work. Whether our legislation is onerous, you see, it depends on who you speak to in relationship to the onerous nature of our legislation. And it also depends on when you speak to the IMF, for example, or the World Bank in relationship to our to the onerous nature of employment. However, the World Bank, for example, in the support on our legislation has indicated that the fundamentals of our labor legislation are sound. There's nothing wrong with our labor legislation. The fundamentals are sound. And therefore, the impact that it would have on employment, for example, the onerous nature is just about hiring and firing of workers. That's the nature of the assessment of onerous nature and the cost of employment, if you will. So research has been done in relationship to the impact, and we will probably do a broader study in the relationship to the impact of our legislation on employment going forward. As I've indicated, the national minimum wage has been in the process of review. There has been a decision to review the national minimum wage for an interim basis. The commission has recommended to the minister, and it will go to the president to at least increase, because the study, as I've indicated, is not finalized as yet, to at least increase the national minimum wage by inflation. Not the 5% that you've seen in the newspapers and the noise that has been made in relationship to the levels of increase in the national minimum wage. Mind you, I must indicate that the representation of the parties in the National Minimum Wage Commission has an equal contribution share between organized business, organized labor, and community. And those parties have agreed in the National Minimum Wage Commission to at least request the minister and the president to increase the national minimum wage as an interim measure by inflation. So I feel that it's important that I raise a point, because this is a collective, again, that's a consensus decision through social dialogue that request has come to us, and that is on the table currently. So there is a decision to at least increase the national minimum wage by at least inflation for the next round, so that when the research is done, there's evidence in terms of what the impact of the national minimum wage would be. That has been done by the National Minimum Wage Commission, and a recommendation has been made in that regard. The issue of child labour. The law is very clear, Honourable Chair. The law says no child should work. And I must make again a distinction between employment and labour. If that work has an impact on the child's schooling, its health and safety, and there's a number of issues that has been raised in relationship. It says a child should not work after the age of 6 years and provide a qualification until the child completes formal schooling in this regard. So, for example, if my child mows the lawn, which they never do, for which is because it's big. If my child mows the lawn for 5 hours a day and it impacts on his or her schooling, that work a child is not allowed to do. That work, the law is clear. The child is not allowed to do that kind of work. So by inference, therefore, then a child should not work, for example, in the agricultural sector. A child should not be used to work in the spaza shop that you or his parents, for example, run, because that's where we find children working. The child should not work in subsistence agriculture. unless that work does not have a negative impact on the child's education, his well-being, and his health in terms of that. So the law is clear. Is there some work that we need to do in relationship to child work? I think we've covered it holistically. I don't think there's need for an amendment in relationship to child labor in the country. As you rightfully say, it's a question of enforcement. It's a question of us being able. But you would also recall, Chair, that child labor is by its nature hidden. It's going to be it's very difficult. You can have a complaint about child labor in a specific entity. When you get there, children are not found in terms of. So it's a hidden form of employment. But again, I guess our vigilance will have to be mindful of that reality in terms of child labour. So the law is adequate, the law is ample, the law does not need to be amended in relationship to child labour, unless we want to provide specific protections that are currently not provided. For example, child-headed households is an example. But again, we don't want children in a child-headed household to be working. Their fundamental job is to go to school and learn. And therefore, there are other manners in which we need to deal with child-headed households, such as our social security net, that we need to extend to those households going forward. Chair, I think I've answered all the questions. There's only one question on the learnership that Mr. Mutombo would vote. Secretary.
Thanks, sir. Thank you very much. Chairperson, before I get directly to that question, just to give the context briefly. The Honorable Chairperson, in the area of development of people, there's been a lot of loss. One can cite that just before 1994, you had legislations that were covering what we call the manpower development in Bophuthatswana, in Venda, Ciskei, Transkei, and you had laws that were about development of people, training acts that were in the war, Gwagwa, and so on. But you also had laws that were under central government that covered the four provinces, that were the Manpower Training Act, the Career Guidance and Placement Act. And then you also had laws that were specific in the various sectors, like the Black Builders Training Act in the building industry and so on. Now, post 1994, what we did was to amalgamate and repeal all those pieces of legislation, and in their place emerge with one law, which was the Skills Development Act of 1998. Now that act sought to combine all the skills development interventions that were targeting mainly those who were in employment and those who were not in schooling system, and to regulate how they should actually enter into employment. Now the Manpower Training Act and the Career Guidance Placement Act initially had their own labor relations dispensation, which means that the learners at work, their grievances were dealt with separately. With the introduction of the Skills Development Act, those employees, or that is workers or learners that were entering into employment, there was an alignment with the basic conditions of employment in that their conditions of employment, remunerations, and all that would be regulated in line with the basic conditions of employment, unless they are included in the collective bargaining agreement as per the Labor Relations Act. So that amendment was done. Now, honorable members may recall, some of you, that in 2010 to 2009, a proclamation was made to transfer skills development functions to the Department of Higher Education and Training. And with that, the President also issued an instruction to find a legal way on how best to do that. And
that took us 4 years to separate some functions from the skills development and retained others within the Employment Services Act, but also provided for transitional provisions because some of those aspects could not be resolved until we have the applicable regulation. So in brief, the conditions of employment of learners in learnerships and apprenticeships are regulated in line with the basic conditions of employment provisions. What has not happened entirely, honorable members, has been the understanding of some of those provisions and the strengthening of working relations, because since the CETAs have left the department, there has not been a very strong liaison with the inspections in the department to deal with them, with those cases. However, when inspectors do find such abuse or where such are reported, they deal with them as part of their normal inspections, and maybe that's why they've not been reported as such. There are other areas that are a bit complex, for instance, the internships, where we ended, DPSA, where people enter into employment, ended up coming up with guidelines. But there are all sorts of other schemes that have also emerged, which are not necessarily learnerships. Honorable members may know about the PWP programs. In those instances, the Minister of Employment and Labour issues a determination that also regulates their employment and how they are paid, conditions of employment, etc. But there has been very, very serious instances even within some departments where the sectoral determination was not adhered to, or where despite the exemption, the exemption, departments also went further to apply for variation from the sectoral determination that has been issued. Even the apprenticeships and learnerships, when it comes to basic conditions of employment, the minister does issue a determination. However, when it comes to certain payments, etc., you'll find that other companies will then flout those, but based on the agreements that are signed with the various institutions. And those are some of the areas that in various forums, cabinet, etc., there was an instruction to also tighten that process and get the Ministry for Higher Education and Training, including the institutions in that area, to also work closely with the departments responsible, the police, the Department of Labor, because it's not only the basic conditions of employment. Laws such as the UIF and compensation also apply to them, especially once they enter the labor market, because young people are dying operating some of the machinery, dangerous machinery, and then the compensation follows. Now, if there is no compliance with respect to a whole range of laws, that's why we are also beginning to have problems in terms of learners in the area of employment. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's take the next round of questions. But I suppose for all the entities, the question of assessment is going to come up in the work that you do. So it might have struck Virgil, but I think as the other entities are sitting in, people must start preparing responses on whether there is an assessment that has been conducted on the work that you're doing currently, and where the gaps are, and whether and how those gaps can be filled. Certainly, one of the roles of the portfolio committee is to look at bills when they come to address those gaps. Honourable Member.
Hello. Thank you, Chairperson. Oh, Program Director. No, I'm sorry about that. One, my honored. Let me start by welcoming the presentation. Is that one, when you look at the history of the labor policies, it says like before the democratic dispensation, the labor laws that were enacted by then, they were promoting what we call as this separate development. So then when we came into power during the democratic dispensation in 1994, we then reformed some of the policies to ensure that we cover some of the gaps that we identified by that time. So now, because there are specialists here, I think I need to be opportunistic to say now that one of our mandate as this department is to ensure that we preserve jobs, we secure more jobs, and we address the issue of unemployment. That is a challenge currently. So I'm just posing a question to say, don't you think it's high time for policy reforms that will ensure that we actually address the current crisis that we're facing as South Africa? Hence, we are rated as one of the countries that is having a high unemployment rate in the world. Or do you think the current policies that we have or pieces of legislation, are they going to address the challenges? That's the first question that I need to understand. Because the pieces of legislation should be informed by the current challenges that we're facing as the country. Yeah. Secondly, program director, is to say I'm happy that the Basic Conditions of Employment Act also address the informal sector from what the presenter presented in saying there is a provision for child labor, especially those who are performing arts and those who are in advertisement. So how are we as the department in terms of our compliance and regulation function to ensure that there is no exploitation in this sector, because some can actually take an advantage of this particular provision to exploit the children and make them do what the act doesn't actually cover. I don't know how are we. The last part is on the employment equity chair. I can't remember what slide. Yeah. I heard from your presentation that I can't even say that you said there is an advisory board that actually advises the minister on issues of employment equity, and you did mention that in top management we are not actually doing very well, and whites are still dominant. So what is it that should be done after receiving such a report? What are the measures that should be implemented to ensure that even the private sector that you have mentioned does comply? And what is our role as the portfolio committee? What should we do to enforce our to strengthen our oversight role? What is the role of the officials of the department that they should do? Because we can't have such critical reports that we're going to pile and not do anything about. So that's my question. And one last thing on enforcement, inspection and enforcement my lady there. I don't know, because you presented plus minus 9 pieces of legislation, so I'm trying to connect dots. I'm a bit confused because we're in an orientation here. I need a clarity. Because I've seen some of the pieces of legislation, they should be implemented in your entity commissioner. So I'm trying to think that if you see that somewhere, somehow, maybe it's issues of the other one that talks about occupational health and safety. So if maybe you pick up that in this in company A or organization A, the issues of health and safety are very bad. In fact, the institution is not complying. So after receiving such information, maybe let's say you do your site inspection, you populate the report, what do you do? Do you refer it to a relevant entity, or do you, I'm just trying, I'm lost somehow, because even there's this one of compensation, if, where do they get into the process? Is it you guys who are enforcing and inspecting, or is it them who should be doing that? So I just need a clarity around those issues. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor. Honorable Chair and members, thanks for the presentation. I think I need to understand something. We have got laws, for example, that addresses issues of basic conditions of employment and all related matters. And surely the law is explicit on what needs to be done. But you know, in the public, the story of a farm worker is not a good story to tell in this country. A story of a private security guard is not a good story to tell. In fact, a few days back, I watched on TV some security young men who were being interviewed, I think by ENCA or so. When they were asked some questions, somebody said, no, we're getting paid 2,500 rand. Somebody said, we are underage. You know, underage. And that is not the first incident. I mean, in the country there is an outcry about that. And, you know, you look at your hospitality sector, you know, one old grandmother actually told me that, hey, look, I won't now go to have lunch in the Nando's. And then I said, why? Because she says, no, I was forced to actually speak English when I can't. So now you can see that there's a language barrier. So somewhere this law talks about the employment of the foreign nationals, as we refer to them. And I wanted to understand firstly that is it, according to your observation, possible to, you know, embark on policy reforms based on the fact that we are facing a high rate of unemployment? You know, policy reforms that will prioritize South Africans as compared to, I'm not saying the current one does not, but I'm saying if there are 100 job opportunities, everybody who is in this country actually, you know, if he or she is here in whatever way and qualifies for that, we will all swim in the same. And I was thinking that I heard something, for example, in Ghana, that the government there has actually said that for any informal trading or in small business, no foreign national can actually be part of that. It's for Ghanaians. And I thought, you know, I think as South Africans, I also feel that we are afraid of tackling issues like that, because maybe we'll be referred as xenophobic. And I'm trying to find, you know, any professional view that will talk about policy reforms, but also in a way that is not xenophobic. Because to me, it's not xenophobic to say out of 100 jobs, 8 or 9 should be reserved for South Africans, because that is how we will fight this thing of unemployment, according to myself. Then 10 or whatever percentage may be given to anybody who is here legally. I don't think that is xenophobic, but perhaps we need to get a kind of a language that is acceptable. I don't know, but I need maybe your comment on that. And on the issue of the security, private security industry, what do you think should be done, and where do you think is, you know, the are the gaps? Because really, this thing is worrying. And in some instances, I heard that in Johannesburg, for example, one leader I can't mention was actually complaining that most security, private security guards, that's where sometimes you'll get illegal firearms. And that's where you'll find illegal immigrants, they are working there. I don't know. No, exploitation is very high in that sector. So where do you think is the gap, so that maybe, you know, as lawmakers, we'll try and close the gaps, because I think that is very important, program director. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks very much, program director, and we welcome the presentation. Chair, you would recall that during the second and the third administration, there were complaints, especially from the organized business, that the South African labor laws are too rigid. And then the matters were addressed at NEDLAC level at the time. Now, my concern is that, let me rephrase, has therefore then the communication at NEDLAC level been beefed up to address those concerns? Because it seems as if once there has been an amendment to a Labor Relations Act or a Labor Related Act, there is this threat of withdrawing investments. And secondly, that these laws are an impediment to investment into the economy. Surely there has been an international labor standard and benchmarking that has been done in relation to the promulgation of any act or
amendment to. Now, my question really centers around the communication at NEDLAC level, because that's where the negotiations and most of the presentations and research is done, so that the public at large would therefore then be informed about the outcomes of a particular act. I would take that as well. This benchmarking has been done in relation to the same economies or similar economies internationally with South Africa. I once asked a question, I can't recall when, whether that question was going to be answered at a later stage when we were discussing the NEDLAC report, that is small business represented one way or the other at a NEDLAC level, or organized business is just business not looking at the differentiation of the economies of scale of different businesses, take into account that most of the matters that affect small businesses economically might not be the same with those who are big business, and the labor force at that level as well has that differentiation. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, you would have noted that I allowed more questions than I did in the first round, because there's a relation in the questions that are being asked. And I think just to recap before we take the responses, this round started off with the issue of current legislation and policies, and whether the current legislation has any direct impact on unemployment. Coupled with that issue as the issue to cap exploitation, which in fact leads to the next set of questions that we were asked on what happens when there's a report, and more specifically the report on employment equity was raised, that it makes recommendations. What has then happened? How are those recommendations going to be implemented, and what role can the portfolio committee play as part of its oversight role to ensure that what the legislation seeks to achieve is in fact achieved, and the gaps that have been identified, particularly in set reports, are in fact implemented. The same applies around the issue of compliance and enforcement. What happens thereafter once there's a report from an inspector that says these transgressions have happened? Who takes ownership? Who ensures prosecution if prosecution has to be done? And I suppose part of the overarching questions is it myth or fact that in fact the labor laws are affecting our economy detrimentally, and particularly around the issue of unemployment, which seems to be an example of the alleged effect that the labor laws have. And just to close it off, right at the end, are SMEs in fact represented at NEDLAC? You know, or when we talk of business, we only talk of big business. So they are the issues, Virgil. I don't know how the department is going to split them, but if we can try and cover these issues. Thank you.
Let me preface my answer with this bit of information. Each piece of legislation, before it's promulgated, is preceded by a socio-economic impact assessment of study. There is a requirement of legislation before it goes to comes to Parliament. There is a socio-economic impact assessment that needs to be done on the impact of the, that piece of legislation would have on a broad range of issues. Some of it for labour legislation fundamentally is economic impact, impact on employment, impact on the livelihoods of workers that need to take into consideration. These pieces of legislation, all of them in its development, well, not all of them, some of them are older than the implementation of the SEAS report requirement, has been predicated by a report on the socio-economic impact assessment for that piece of legislation. And when you, if you recall, for example, for the amendment to the Basic Conditions of Employment Act, the establishment of the National Minimum Wage Act, one of the critical areas of a document that we needed to submit to this House is a socio-economic impact assessment report that's been done on these pieces already. So I thought that in answering the questions, I prefaced my answer on these issues. Does the current, and let me deal with the critical one, does the current legislation respond to the current environment that we have? Our report, it is very clear, it's not only employment that impacts on our reasoning in relationship to amendment to the legislation. It's a changing nature of work, the world of work, that also impacts on our assessment of whether there's a need for a change and revision of policy. For example, we have to clearly look at the impact of the fourth, and I know it sounds blasé, but we have to clearly look at the impact of the 4IR in relationship to whether our legislation responds effectively to the need of the current situation. Whether the changing nature of work, in respect to the changing nature of work, our legislation responds effectively to the changing nature of work that we see. So it's important that those factors that we have listed now informs our decision on whether there's a need for a review of the policy environment that we have. I'll deal with the issue on the employment equity and the slow pace of change. Let me call it the slow rate of change in terms of that is reflected in the Commission of Employment Equity's report. And the question is, what should be done? The notion of the Employment Equity Act, as I have indicated, is predicated on voluntary compliance. So there is no compulsion on any employer in the law to change his employment patterns. Nothing in the law compels an employer to say that I will employ 5 senior black people instead of 2 white senior black people. The law requires that the company and its workers develop an employment equity plan, and they report on that employment equity plan. So the law does not require or demand that there should be change in the workplace. The employer sets that, the employer with his employees sets that target for themselves. And I think I needed to just make that very clear. And perhaps there's some debate in relationship to whether we should be more prescriptive or not in terms of that. What we are now doing is to set, and that's part of the amendment, that we set sectoral targets. That in a sector, the company will meet the sector will meet the following target in a specific period. So that's the one area where we've intervened, where we set sectoral targets, or we want to set sectoral targets, so that we get to a rate of change that is faster than what we've seen over the last couple of years since the implementation of the Employment Equity Act. The second thing, we've changed the enforcement regime. We've increased the cost of non-compliance in the amendment. The cost of non-compliance to your own employment equity plan, mind you, not to a plan that the department has prescribed for you, but an employment equity plan where you have not complied. We want to increase the rate of non-compliance in terms of, because Because that's the basis on which the act is predicated on. The third thing that we've done is the point that I've raised in relationship to doing business with the state. Now, granted, it will not cover all of the employees in this regard, but it will at least cover those doing business with the state in terms of, is it more that we should do, we can do, we possibly can do more. We can actually be prescriptive in the legislation. But when we become prescriptive, already at the inception of the Employment Equity Act, it was an area of serious contestation. Serious contestation in relationship to where we are and where we were at that point and where we're going to in relationship to the. So we've got to take all of these into consideration when we consider the role of the portfolio committee, this house in relationship to dealing with this issue. I think as we go through this process, the oversight responsibility of this commission assists us tremendously in relationship to the work that we do, and therefore I think the strengthening that oversight commitment should be part of the work. With respect to the private security sector, Chair, was a question. We have established, or the industry. Let me rephrase it. The industry has established a bargaining council for the private security sector. We've been struggling for years to establish a bargaining council in the private security sector. We are now at a point where a bargaining council is established. There's an agreement that is currently on the place, on the table, which has been reached within this industry. Can I just point out, this is one of the sectors where industrial action in this sector was highly conflictual. It actually led to the loss of lives in the sector. In the last 19... Cameron, assist me if I'm wrong. The last strike within the sector saw the loss of at least 6 lives in the private security sector. After the intervention and with the current intervention of the CCMA, we have not seen that kind of adversarialism in the private security sector. So we're getting to a point where the private security sector is an example of the ability for collective bargaining and shared ownership in the sector. It's getting to a point where we actually have dealt with the issues in the private security sector. You asked a broader question in relationship to the use of foreign nationals in the private security sector, but the private security sector bill, the private security, and my name may be the naming of the act, it may be wrong, which established, for example, the Private Security Industry Regulatory Authority, CISA, actually said what are the criteria for private security officers would be in the country. It's not a function of this piece of legislation, but there's a broader attempt in relationship to dealing with those kinds of queries issues that you've raised. Is our legislation rigid? I've noted, for example, let me deal with the Basic Conditions of Employment Act as an example. The flexibility contained within the Basic Conditions of Employment Act is broad. I've raised the issue of individual agreements that is made provision for the basic condition, collective agreements that have been made provision for, and all of these agreements can vary the conditions of employment within the sector. Dealing with the rigidity of the labour market, because that's where the rigidity lies. We also have the notion of variation that are built into the legislation, not only in terms of the Basic Conditions of Employment Act, as well as but also the sectoral determination that we have. So we have this variation principle that is built into the law. So, for example, if you cannot afford a minimum wage, there's a mechanism in law to deal with your inability to pay these. So our legislation is sufficiently flexible. We think a study by the World Bank done some years ago on the basis of our current legislation found that found that the fundamentals of our labour legislation is sound. Thanks.
Maybe also to just raise a number of points. The first one relates to how we relate and link and always benchmark our laws against labor laws in other countries. We have what we call in the ILO conventions, and some of these conventions date back to the establishment of the International Labor Organization, and they remain valid even to this day. We may not have ratified a number of some of those conventions, but the core ones we have ratified. There are others that we have not ratified, and our laws are benchmarked against those, and we continue to review and adjust based on that. But what the ILO also does every ILC during June is that there's a debate on a certain aspect, and either linked to each convention, further guidelines come up, and those guidelines are then used by individual member states to then adjust our legislation accordingly. For instance, the issue that Mr. Seafield referred to on the fourth industrial revolution, you look at new industries that are emerging, the Uber, and there are lots of others within the ICT and so on, where the whole question of the employer-employee relationship is not very clear because people operate remotely. So the question then, like Chair, you raised issues around how do you cap the issues around Uber. Mr. Mafate will tell you when he does his presentation on some of the challenges they are faced. You get taxi drivers, taxify, Uber drivers fighting, and then Uber driver dies. But the Uber driver was working on an app registered remotely. And the employer then says, no, but this person was not employed by me. They were having their own car, etc. So what it means and what he was saying is that every time there are changes within employment patterns, we also have to then go back and look at our laws. But I think the other issue that we wanted to raise was that some of the questions were going to be answered in detail when we do the different presentations. I can go on to the immigration, but when I come to that presentation, you'll find that I would have provoked other questions, and that question would not be answered in detail. So we can answer them, or I can note that question, and when I come to employment services, answer it in detail. But the other point, honorable members, is that what Mr. Seafield was doing was to give you the framework of the laws that we operate under. And all our divisions here, when CCMA speaks, they will go back again to the same Labor Relations Act to say Provision X establishes us to do 1, 2, 3, and then expand on that. The same with employment services. We'll say that and then give you the context within which productivity and SEE operate within the very same laws, and then begin to deal with some of the details. Thank you.
No, thanks, Sam. You read my mind. There's certainly, I think, a number of the issues that have been raised. I've captured them, and I will go back to them when the different presentations are made. The issues around inspection and enforcement, Meg is going to deal with that as soon as we come back from tea. So those issues that were raised, I've noted them. At a more beneficial path than Virgil, because you know exactly what the issues are before you even deal with your presentation, so you might want to incorporate those responses as you deal with such. Similarly, Mr. Morojane is here. The issues around the rigidity of the Labor Relations Act itself, and whether it's cumbersome and problematic, and what its implications are on the labor market, I mean, he will deal with them, and so forth. I mean,
Tebogo is going to deal with UIF issues. Some of these issues have been raised, and I think they will be answered in the different presentations that are still going to come up. You won't escape. I've noted all the questions. So if it's not answered, I'm going to come back to it, and your entity will have to deal with it. Thank you for the informative presentation, Virgil. We're going to take tea now. It's 11:15. Because of the issues that come up, may I request that we just take 15 minutes so that we're able to get through everything that we need to get through today. It's now 14 minutes past. I'm giving you an extra minute, so we'll take 16 minutes. We stand adjourned. Once we're done with inspection and enforcement, I've discussed it with the chair. We just need to accommodate Professor Singh. She's going to come after inspection and enforcement because of logistical arrangements. So we'll accommodate her as number three, and then we'll continue with the program. That's the first thing. That's fine. The second issue is that may I also request from the presenters that are going to come. I think, yes, we're in a workshop mode, but the issues are quite crisp now. So I would appreciate in your presentation just to also cover the issues that have surfaced. And most importantly, the issue of assessment. It's an issue that cuts across assessment. What are the gaps, if any gaps exist, and what the entity is doing to close those gaps. You know, so if we could just touch on those three issues as part of the presentation that we're making, it would help us a great deal. Thank you. Let me call upon Ms. Egi Muela to assist us with the inspection and enforcement. Thank you. Over to you, Egi.
Thank you, Program Director. Okay. I think the chairperson, you kind of set a beautiful scene for us, and I'm moving from understanding that worker rights are human rights, and that we premise everything that we do within the context of decent work as stipulated in the ILO. There was an issue of job preservation raised by Honorable Gavan. Actually, inspection enforcement services, it's at the crux of ensuring that jobs are preserved. It shouldn't serve as any purpose of the country to create jobs that are not going to be sustained at the end of the day. Both sustained and sustainable. So in terms of ensuring that people are productive, people are safe, people earn remuneration that they should be getting, and that they're kept as health and safe as possible. If you look at the first slide, I've just indicated that inspection enforcement service is constituted by the Labour Inspectorate. We've got about 1,880 inspectors across the board. We are in the process of recruiting 500 new OHS inspectors. So the figure is going to go beyond 2,320 inspectors in the entire country. We've got statutory services, we've got registration services. The registration services deals mainly with registration of professionals around construction, around electrical, and so on. Statutory services, I'm just going to give a bit of more detail as I continue. Administration is really just the auxiliary or support services within the entity of the inspectorate. If we go to the next page, our inspectors specialize in a program director, so we don't have an inspector doing an integrated function. For instance, with regards to basic conditions of employment, we've got BCA inspectors. In that space, we've got about 1,300, which constitutes 70% of the entire inspectorate. And then we've got Employment Equity Inspectorate. We've got 9 specialists for the entire country. And then we've got about 60 supporting inspectors within the employment equity space. Then with regards to occupational health and safety, we've got about 190 that are active as we speak, and like I indicated earlier on, 500 that are in the process of being recruited. I mean, the various provinces are in the different stages of recruiting, but the majority of them have shortlisted. And then we also have unemployment insurance inspectorate. Mostly we call them payroll auditors. So they look into the payroll of companies and look at declarations as well as payments within the UIF space. We've got about 120 of those. With regards to the COIN space, currently we've got about 60. But please bear in mind that occupational health and safety is a preventative arm of the compensation fund. So the 500 inspectors that are coming in are going to solely serve as the preventative arm of the compensation fund. So it's going to be over 500 inspectors that are going to be looking into issues of COID. When you go to the next page, I'm not going to spend time on that, just basically to say those are the laws that we administer. Virgil Seafield spoke about the laws within the context of putting them together. What IES does is to ensure that those are implemented and that they are the offerings of various laws are complied with. So in a way, IES gives life to the laws that the department has got. If you go to the next page, you'll see that the branch is comprised by an Inspector General, a DDG, IES. There are two chief directorates. One chief directorate deals with statutory and advocacy services, and the other one with OHS. There are five directorates. Like I indicated, the number of inspectors, I'm not going to go back to that, but if you go to the next page, the next page is now telling you about what statutory and advocacy services does. This was established to strengthen the enforcement arm of the inspectorate. There was a time, program director, when we really were overemphasizing on inspections and we're very weak on enforcement. So in the past about 5-6 years, we've really strengthened the enforcement arm because it wasn't going to assist us to find non-compliance and not deal with it quite decisively. So you'll notice that if you go to the next page, that statutory services is responsible for drafting guidelines on training manuals and also on the standard operating procedures for the inspectors, the interpretation of legislation for implementation purposes, providing of legal opinions and dealing with opposed matters and litigate on behalf of the department in areas where there's failure to comply. As my presentation continues, you'll see how we interact with the courts because the value chain within enforcement also talks about in instances where employers fail to adhere to notices that have been given, the next phase will be referral to prosecution. So depending on what the law that has been contravened is, then we'll refer to different legal institutions. The chief directorate also capacitates inspectors, provides technical support. Inspectors are capacitated. When we get new inspectors, we don't right away send them to the field. We've got an orientation and induction program that lasts about 6 months. So during this period in time, there's extensive training on the legal prescripts, on the SOPs, and then there's also mentoring that takes place as well as coaching. So the first day they'll go to a workplace, they'll be accompanied by a mentor or a coach so that they're then kind of assisted to assimilate into the system of inspections. We attract quite high-skilled individuals, but it doesn't matter how high-skilled you are. When you come into a new environment, you've got to learn the ropes and the how things are done in that space, so hence our extensive training. We also train employers as well as employees. Our approach has always been both stick and carrot. So we've trained a number of shop stewards on the offerings of day, because you know, inspectors cannot be everywhere. So it is important that even people that are in the union, for instance, have got to empower their own members in terms of their rights. So I did indicate that currently we've got just under 2,000 labor inspectors for more than 60 million working population. So already you can see that the ratio is not too great. We also train employers. The employers that approach us and say, please take us through this north. And then contrary to what could be believed out there, we are both, we're not just pro-employees, but we're pro-employers as well. Because we understand that in the quest of compliance, every single person has got a role to play. Employers have got a role to play. Employees have got a role to play. There are instances where you go out to conduct inspections. An employer can give employees protective clothing, but you find some of the employees don't wear them. And also, no, these things are irritating and so on. So it's a dual responsibility. So wherever we go, we do preach that gospel of ensuring that everyone plays their role. You look at, you'll see head office, the sheriff services, I'm not going to go into detail about that, but safe to say that at a provincial level, we've got provincial chief inspectors. So each and every province has got a provincial chief inspector who is in charge of the entire inspectorate. And also with regards to statutory services itself, we've got statutory people. All of them are lawyers that have got, that are advocates, have got a right to appear before the court. So each and every province has got at least one person. But some have got two, depending on the size of the province, that are able to assist us with enforcing the laws. The next page, just an indication that our statutory services people are responsible for referral of cases to the CCMA in relation to national minimum wage, and also to the labor court in relation to the BCA, as well as the employment equity issues, magistrate court in relation to occupational health and safety. Because with occupational health and safety, you refer it to the magistrate court. They also provide legal opinions, and like I said, they also provide training in respective provinces. And the other chief directorate that is in the branch is occupational health and safety. This was established through the OHS Act that was put in place in 1993. You'll notice that that act predates democracy, so already it's a challenge there. And that is why there's a new bill, Occupational Health and Safety Bill, that is in the process of being finalized. I'm going to go to the next page in terms of the purpose of the act. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that because when Virgil was presenting, I think he did indicate what the purpose of the law was. But if you go to the next page, you'll notice that the Occupational Health and Safety Act has got 21 regulations that have been promulgated through Section 43 of the OHS Act. And these regulations are spread across the three directorates of occupational health and safety. And then if you go to the next slide, you'll see that in terms of the directories that we have in the OHS space, we've got construction, explosives, and major hazard installations. So, and then there are regulations underneath. So those regulations that are under the like constructions and so on, they are regulated by under the construction, explosives and major other installations. Then you go to the next layer, it shows that you also have occupational health and hygiene. Under that, you've got regulations such as asbestos, diving, and so on. I don't want to go into details because the slide is really self-explanatory. The last directory that you have is electrical and mechanical, and under there you'll find the various regulations that we are enforcing under the space of OHS. So in total, it's 21 regulations that we are enforcing. And then the inspection model is based on three pillars. We've got advocacy, like I indicated earlier on, that we are really strong on advocacy. We've got structured advocacy, where we'll have outreach campaigns. We utilize media. We also conduct seminars and conferences. All that is part of advocacy. Then inspections themselves, we go out to conduct inspections. Actually, the model of inspection is such that inspectors are expected to be in the field. They are field workers. They are expected to be in the field at least for 4 days in a week. And then the one day is then reserved to do admin work, such as writing reports and so on. And then the last pillar that we have is enforcement. Now, enforcement is triggered when there's failure to comply with notices that have been issued in contravention of any law that I've mentioned that is within our mandate. If you go to the next page, you'll see that we've tried to show a linkage between our internal and external stakeholders. For instance, if you look at public employment services, my brother next to me, we are co-joined in that we look at issues of immigration and employment services. Although our inspectors are specialists, there are things that in the nature of doing their work, we expect them to look at. Like for instance, when inspectors go to the field, one of the standard questions that they will ask will be how many employees. Obviously we do our own homework, but just to test how many employees are here, any foreign nationals, and then we look at the payroll, we look at the legality of the people that are in the country. Some of our inspectors, we invite home affairs. Well, sometimes it's not easy if you're not trained. Even if a person may have documents, it's not easy to judge whether the documents are legitimate or not if you're not trained. But we look at all those things as a standard. All our inspectors across the board and look at it. And when a potential employer wants to bring in foreign labor, I think Mr. Murotoma will touch on that. But what we do on the side of inspection and enforcement services is to go out and conduct inspection in that workplace. You know, we look at issues around the wages, issues around health and safety and everything. So that's how we collaborate. We also collaborate on issues around I can't remember who, but there's one of the honourable members that spoke about employment. The department has got, through the Public Employment Services, a database where we have work seekers that are registered. So when we go out, one of the things that we ask is, where do you have vacancies? How do you fill these vacancies? And just last week, we went to Toyendo, and it was pleasing with the Murotoma to find that 100% of their vacancies are filled by employees that are in the database of the department. In some instances, we don't find that. And I'm just showing collaboration that we do collaborate. With regard to the compensation fund, I spoke about OHS and the Comp Fund, and then I also spoke about the Unemployment Insurance Fund. Labor Policy and Industrial Relations, that this was demonstrated as well through the presentation of the Mr. Seyfeld. With regards to the CMA, I've mentioned that we collaborate around the area of national minimum wage implementation. Externally, our stakeholders are mainly the law enforcers. We've got the NPA, we've got courts, sheriffs, and so on. One of the biggest challenges is that the courts are very lenient when it comes to assisting us to hold non-compliance employers responsible. I'll give you an example. If you are found to have contravened OHS and we give you a notice, and then you don't comply with the notice, then we refer you to the magistrate court. You know that for admission of guilt, it's only 500 rand. So there are some of the amendments that are being brought in as to the now the cost of human life, really, people are going to begin to feel it because the penalties are going to be quite high. Currently, the penalties are quite strong. If you look at the employment equity space, you refer and non-like virtual assistants, it's voluntary. They'll put in, they submit reports that they don't comply with, and when you issue out DG recommendations, they don't comply, you refer them to the court, they charge them, I mean, take a JSE listed company, they fine them something like 250,000, which is a really small change. Although the law does make provision for a maximum penalty of up to 1.5 million, no workplace has ever been fined the maximum. So it's always, I know that at the very beginning, the precedent that was set where one court set the fine at 250,000. So that has become the standard somehow. So it really undoes some of the work that you do, the leniency with regards to penalty. We work with various government. If you think about occupational health and safety, the mining sector has got occupational health and safety. So the Department of Minerals Resources, we work closely with them. The Department of Health has got elements of health and safety, so we do collaborate with those departments. Work with professionals and in the field such as engineering, health and hygiene. We work with academics. South Africa is the first country in the whole world to have an ergonomics regulation that has been promulgated, I mean globally. So we work with institutions of higher learning also to promulgate and to put together such laws. There are various pockets of excellence that one may not have the time to go into. And then the next slide, which is the last, is talking about our inspection methodology. If you check how, or just practically, the type of inspections that we have, it's number one, a proactive inspection, and secondly, a reactive inspection. A proactive inspection is a planned inspection, and how do we plan this? We plan this inspection on the basis of intelligence that we gather ourselves. Now, we get this from our administrative data. We link systemically with the CF as well as the UI. So what we'll do, we'll go to the register of the highest claimants, for instance, with regards to occupational injuries. If you look at wholesale and retail, I can disclose here that ShopRite is the biggest claimant. And it could be that they've got the highest employees in the country, they've got in excess of 25,000. So you find injuries are also prone, and will therefore target sectors that present as high risk in that way. And we also look at the trend of complaints that we gather. I think Honourable Member raised an issue around private security. Private security is one of the problematic sectors, and therefore we proactively plan at a sectoral level, and in instances where a sector is problematic, we kind of plan nationally. We would have a national approach, either blitzes. Well, sometimes we interchange inspectors because some of the inspectors become comfortable with an area or where they work. So we interchange and we'll go and just bleed and try and clean a particular area. So we work with the PCRA, for instance. You were spot on when you say more often than not, security people don't have a good story to tell. Only last week, I had two complaints already. One, I was in the mall, and I mean, I believe that everyone should be an inspector. So when you walk around and there are problems, alert us to those problems, because it's impossible for us to cover each and every one thing. But where there are clearing problems, by all means, we can go and do some inspection. So last week, like I was saying, just a guy standing next to the, you ask questions and you find that there's no lease, there's no contract of employment, and basically everything that could be flouted gets flouted. So that's how we try and attack areas that are problematic. So we believe that we could have small numbers, but if we use them creatively, we can be able to cover a lot of ground. So we've got high problematic sectors, and then we have high risk sectors that we plan for. Then we have reactive inspections. Reactive inspections are triggered by complaints from various sources. Now, with regards to the type of notices that we issue, our notices, I should say, are valid for a duration of 14 to 60 days, depending on the law that is being contravened. We issue out an undertaking. I'll give an example. If we go out and conduct an inspection on the national minimum wage, and you find that the employer is paying, for instance, 2.5 a month instead of 3.5, or less than 20 rands per hour, or whatever, 20 rands, it's 15 rands, it depends, the national minimum wage is paid on that. We make calculations on the spot, and you'll be surprised how high they are. I think the time when we were in Zanim, in one farm, the underpayment went to about 2.3 million of workers. So what we do, we don't issue an undertaking, we secure an undertaking. So by securing an undertaking, it means the employer, him or herself, must sign that undertaking that I'm going to, and we give them 14 days. You say you've got 14 days to settle this. If they don't settle the underpayments within 14 days, we then trigger referral for prosecution. And in about 85% of the cases, they comply within the 14 days. So the other remaining 15, that's where you refer them to court and so on. Some do make an arrangement, and then we'll bring in the workers as well so that it becomes an arranged and agreed upon type of an arrangement. Prime Director, I'm spending time on this portion because it's the one that has the majority of questions. So that is why we say we secure an undertaking. Unless a person is then validated acting CEO, we don't accept any signature. Because we've seen that they like playing in this space. If you don't get an undertaking from the owner of the company or the boss themselves, we'll rather delay and come back maybe at a later stage. But we don't. We make sure that we get the person, the right person. So undertakings are valid for 14 days. And then we also have what we call a compliance order. I'll make an example. In the BCA space, say for instance, the law says every worker must be provided with a contract of employment. They must get payslips. They need to be given leave days off, sick leave, with or without a sick note, and so on. And then you find that in that space, sometimes there are a lot of contravention. So we issue out a compliance order, and then the compliance order also will last 14 days. So within 14 days, they must have corrected whatever needs to be corrected. But I make an example, like in the space of employment equity, where you find the law prescribes that there must be an appointment of an employment equity manager who reports to the CEO. Sometimes we don't find that, so we give them a bit of time to comply. So that's what you mean by a compliance order. Compliance order runs across most of the laws except the OHS. And then when we come to the occupational health and safety space, we've got three type of notices. The first one, we call it an improvement notice or a directive. Now, what an improvement notice means is that in instances where you find contravention with housekeeping issues. Small issues, if I have to put it that way. Like, for instance, here's a step ladder, and there's no one that is using a step ladder at that point in time. You just say, you'd issue out a directive and say, please make sure that when instruments are not being used, they need to be removed. Because if you leave things all over the floor, they pose a health and safety risk. So your housekeeping must be clean. Like, and sometimes you find there's a fire extinguisher, but it's obscured by boxes or things like that. Just general housekeeping. That's when you issue out the directive. Then we have what we call a contravention notice within OHS again. In the contravention notice space, where, for instance, a company or a workplace doesn't have a safety committee, because the law is clear, in Section 8, that there must be a safety committee in each and every workplace. So where there's no safety committee, we'll issue a contravention notice, as an example. Or where there's no incident register, the law prescribes that there must be a register that shows the type of incident, how many, and what was done, and so on. So, or when there's no, maybe a risk assessment, because there must be a risk assessment in each and every workplace. So if it's not there, we issue out what we call a contravention notice. And then we give our company 60 days to comply. And then we go back just to make sure that those things have been dealt with. So you cannot invoke, or is it revoke? When you lift, you cannot revoke a contravention notice from the office. You need to go and check that whatever was a finding has been dealt with. Then lastly, under OHS, we've got a prohibition notice. Now, a prohibition notice says where, in the opinion of the inspector, there is immediate danger to lives of people or people that are around there, then you need to prohibit the place. When you prohibit, it means you can either prohibit a space or a machine. Like, for instance, if there's a forklift, the requirement is that the forklift anyone that uses the forklift must be licensed. And the forklift itself, there must be a register of maintenance. But if you find that you don't have such, you can prohibit that machine itself and say, you're not going to use it until you produce a maintenance register of some sort. So where there's immediate danger to people's lives. I mean, there are instances where you find the whole electrical or the wiring and everything is wrong. There's no certificate of competence, nothing. So we stop production there and there when we foresee that there could be danger. And then within the occupational health and safety space, when there's failure, Honorable Government, to comply with those notices, we then trigger the route of referrals to court. But like I said, in the value chain itself, there are weaknesses that are beyond the control of the inspector. Lastly, I want to talk about challenges in enforcing laws in the informal sector. There was an issue that was raised around the informal sector. While there's provision that is made, but there are challenges in enforcing laws. I'll just give two examples. Let's look at the waste pickers. Those people are in the informal sector. Who is employing them? Who is looking after their health and safety issues? Which office are you going to go to for you to enforce certain laws? Let's look at people that sell vendors. I'm vendor, but not this vendor. Yeah, those that are selling. You look at ergonomics regulations. Ergonomics regulations within the OHS space say a person, the environment has got to be adjusted to an individual, not the other way around. If you can do an ergonomics inspection here, you may find that you can find contraventions. Because the chairs and everything are standard, but people are not standard. So look at a person who's selling sweets or whatever, and they're sitting on a box the whole day. They're self-employed. How do you enforce OHS? in terms of ergonomics because their bed and so on. You look at BCA, working hours, a person who is self-employed, what then? And that goes beyond the informal economy. It goes to what Ms. Mdoto was saying in terms of the fourth industrial revolution, the gig economy, where you find the people that work from home, ICT bosses that don't, and the workplace, by definition, a home is not a workplace. How do you regulate the working hours, leave and so on? Because we know that for you to stay productive, you've got to give yourself a break. And then I also want to talk about the child labor issues. They're extremely difficult to enforce. There is one case that we cracked in Free State, I think 2 years back. Colleagues will remember that we went there and the employer was arrested and I think they ultimately either jailed or prosecuted. That's one success story, but it's one in a million. It's not easy. I mean, these children are so trained that when inspectors come in, they run away, they hide. Especially in farms, you're not going to find them. Although you know that they are children somewhere. And then I also want to talk to the issue of joint inspections, that we do blitz joint inspections where we bring in Home Affairs, we bring in the police, SAPS, we bring in just a whole range of people. Because in some instances we find there's child labor, there's potential human trafficking, and illegal immigrants that have got to be arrested on the spot. So we do have these joint inspections. And Program Director, as I conclude, I would like to invite the members of the Portfolio Committee that one day, if you make time, so that you join us in one of the police inspections, that you see practically what happens when we go out to conduct inspections. Thank you.
Thank you. No, no. Perhaps perhaps let me leave it to the questions. I wanted to deal with just your own view on the effectiveness of some of the enforcement measures that you've dealt with. But we'll deal with it. Let me pose questions, Chair.
No, thank you, Chair. This is one of my. Should I say favorite or exciting areas, the inspection and enforcement? I know in health you talk about health and safety, but there's also what then becomes a relationship with the Office of the Health Standard Compliance, because they also do that. I'm raising that, Chair, because I think two cabinets with the president have said now, departments must stop working in silos. You have mentioned mining, the Office of the Health Standard Compliance. But there's one sector which I don't know what then, I'm just trying to get this, if you do have rights, I'm just lacking a better word, because if this department, in particular this, would have gone to that sector, wouldn't have had children that perish in pit lights in toilets. Now, I don't know about inspectors in the Department of Education, I'm not an educator, where do they, what is it that they do? So, in your observation as the Department of Labor, what is your take on to all this thing that is happening in that sector in terms of impact? Just make an example of that, and the appalling state of the infrastructure. We all shout that this is the Department of Education, blah, blah, blah. The minister must be recalled because there are things that we don't take into consideration, but don't you think that as this department you have got I'm asking that program director, because the Department of Health, through its observation around the failure rates in matric, they came up with a program of reviving the school health program, because you can't then start there at matric level. You must start at the early childhood development to really see. So they came up with that program through their observations. So that's why I'm asking, through your observation on these things that are taking everybody by surprise. And as politicians, we shout, we find an area to politicize when it has got its own history. And Chair, I'm not asking that because I'm trying to be defensive, but I'm just saying, in those, then do you, how then do you think you work with the informal settlement, informal sector? I am there, a vendor selling everything under the sun for people to eat, but also to ensure that I generate income. Do you think they will agree? I was once a vendor, by the way. Do you think that they will agree in being regulated? Because they want, they are generating money. As much as the concern is about, obviously it's about their health and safety. So I'm saying, and municipalities, in you conducting your inspections, because municipalities are running away with murder, in not some of them, in not ensuring that they create an enabling environment for these vendors by building those smaller nyana. So I think those are the, in that, those are the questions, Chair, that I, other comments I would raise when I am. Have you ever gone to schools as the department, in particular the, within the context that you are short of, go to schools from grade 10 to check if are there any learners that will be interested in looking into their interests to be inspectors and then be assisted. I'm making an example. If you go to Ekwezi High School in PE or Cowan High School, you find few who said, I would like to be an inspector, and you look into, so that you leave a, what you say, you develop, or you think that you'll find them when they go to universities, because in universities, they become confused. There are so many things there. But my view is that if you pick them from that level, it will be. And this, as Honorable Ngabane said, all these centers around job creation, this, because they are factories, not even farmers. They are factories that are going out away with murder. And the weakness or the challenges, why, what is your observation as the inspector that shop stewards, why are they, why some of them are, don't feel the need? Is there something? The very last, which is on social media, on media space, comment for you. I mean, the master court was closed for 2 days, no? By SIU. Are you confident enough that you don't go, you won't be subjected to that at a particular point? Because the Department of Justice. So you can separate this from what may be happening in that in the area of employers who are doing things that are not right. Obviously, we're in a workshop, as I said, we're not in a portfolio committee. We will ask these raw questions, and you will assist us if you think that as director we are going out of the. But I think it's some of the things. What are the lessons that you are to? What SIU has done? I never thought that that master court can be closed up and be investigated because of maladministration and fraud that is taking place in that space.
Thanks, Chair. Other members?
Honourable member. Thank you very much, Prof. In your presentation, you indicate that we must all be inspectors, and part of the comments that we do or we make are informed by what we see on the ground or hear, and sometimes from the horse's mouth or people who are directly affected by such things. But you know, some of the people are afraid to come out because employers will victimize them, and that is the least they can make their living out of. And how do we, you know, protect the employers in the process of inspection and law enforcement? Something related to that. I hope you will find or understand what I'm talking about. And you see, I'm not trying to be, you know, I don't want to victimize this one. I'm trying to find a correct wording for it. But you know, in South Africa now, in the retail sector, there are these, you know, what we normally call, or it's normally called China malls, China shops, and all that. Have you ever maybe get closer to those people? Because I know, for example, an area around Richards Bay and Bangeni areas where I met employees who worked in such areas. You know, we're actually saying no, we are even not allowed to vote, even in SPA for that matter. You know, SPA, I think you know what is SPA. We said we are not even allowed to be released during the date of voting and all that, and voting is a constitutional right. You know, because as much as we like the investment they are making, but we would like them to comply with the laws of the land. And failure to do that, then this department must get in to enforce compliance. And I don't know, because as the department, Honorable Chair, I think, and Program Director, I think we are faced with a very big task, and there is information that we don't have enough staff and all that. But I know that the Department of Police, Honorable Chair, because of the high levels of crime, and that crime happens every day, you know, they went an extra mile to establish what is called CPF. And when the chairperson was talking about you identifying learners in grade 10, and I thought she was going towards that direction, that can we try and extend so many people who will help us? I don't know, just a model that is like CPF something, but at least people who will keep you informed that in my area, other than members of parliament and staff of the department, but in my area, this and this and this is happening. This and this and this is happening, you see, other than Bimba hotline or whistle blowing and all that. But people who will just be there on the ground on daily basis, I know that CPF, I mean, is not paid, and with a lot of people skilled in the country and unemployed, I think some may be interested in making sure that they lend a hand in things like this. I wanted to comment that way, Program Director. Thank you.
Yeah, no, I forgot something. She knows it's my passion. Do you think it wouldn't be? Do you think it would be, it's correct for either the department or the committee or a member to introduce a bill that will deal with the regulation of foreign nationals in the country? I'm raising this because we have got some, although we have not visited, but I mean it's public knowledge, and I'm clear about the scale in which is within the domain of Home Affairs. But secondly, okay, the second question is, would it not be necessary or important that as the department, you within the inspectorate, you skill those that you think can have an ability and capacity to be able to, when investigating, can see, because I agree with you. You think that the document is authentic and only to find that it's a fraudulent document. I'm raising this question because you said it's something that is not very easy. But would it not be wise that as the department you set aside a fund or request whoever, whether SAPS or whatever is your HOCS or whatever, to assist to empower those within that are going to be specializing on the scale of ensuring that some documents, because we think that the documents are authentic, whereas people are here in South Africa. And I agree with Honorable Ngwezi, and I've told myself that if we are going to allow to be politically blackmailed by when we raise issues that are challenges about foreign nationals, we are always told that we are xenophobic. It's not that we are xenophobic. Comrade Wena, Vuyo, and honorable members, that thing makes me to, it hurts me. A bishop was assaulted, and a human rights commissioner was assaulted here in Cape Town by the foreign nationals that have holded the Cape Town. None of us, when I'm saying us South Africans, none of us made that a media thing. But if it would have clapped, if it was him who would have clapped a foreign national, so that's why I'm saying, for us to be able as lawmakers to ensure that we correct, nurses go to Saudi Arabia, so the issue of migration is not a new thing, London, but they were there according to laws and regulations of that country. It's not about time that the South Africans we do that without succumbing, we succumb to political blackmail within ourselves and by ourselves. So my questions, program director, are linked to that. Thank you.
Excuse me. Thanks, Chair. I take it that there are no other questions from members, and I can ask Mayor Eki to respond. I'm sure you still have the issues, the issue of education, particularly schools, and the regulation of, I don't want to use the word vendors, I think, as well as municipalities. Thanks, Mayor.
With regards to our interactions with the Department of Health, we've got ACOS, the Advisory Council of Health and Safety, that has been put in place via the Occupational Health and Safety. It's an advisory council to the minister with regards to reviews when regulations are put in place and they become core people that deal with the various regulations, even the amendments. So Department of Health is one of the key members in the ACOS space. We also collaborate around issues of HIV and AIDS. The department has got a code of good practice regarding HIV that we enforce, so we collaborate quite extensively with them. If you look at the Directorate Health and Hygiene, everything that is mentioned under the regulations have got a very strong collaborative element with the Department of Health. So we interact with them quite extensively. At a functional level, we inspect as much as we can public institutions also. If you talk to the Department of Health, the Civitas building, our inspectors are the ones that actually closed the portion of it down because it was not complying. We also close our own offices down. There are a few offices of the Department of Labor that have been closed down by our own inspectors. Besides just inspecting public facilities, we've got a program that looks into public facilities, because really some of them, the conditions are quite appalling. So we do have a bad program. With regards to the cost of compliance in the informal sector, I agree with you 100%. And that is why I'm saying it's a very hard space to regulate in a meaningful way. So besides the fact that we're also struggling with resources of our own, it's also like unthinkable that you go into a space where it's highly informal and you try and regulate. It's difficult. So I agree with you. It was a comment, and I agree with you that the cost of compliance in that space is almost unaffordable. And schools and our interest, the department has got a pupil inspector program. We will go to schools and source a few interested pupils, take them through technical universities and so on, and then we employ them as learner pupils. And after, for the policy that regulates, I think currently, of course, I'm not sure of the numbers, but we take in a certain number almost every year. And then after they've completed everything, they get absorbed as inspectors, the majority of them, in the department itself. We're actually wanting to go a step further. There's a Kenyan model that we learned, that what the Kenyans do, they've also introduced OHS as a subject in their schools, so that occupational health and safety becomes everyone's business. Because OHS is everywhere, at your home, and where you work, and everywhere, OHS permeates every environment like that. So we've got those thoughts of having it advocated at that level. Factories are getting away with murder, you are so spot on. Actually, last year we ended up on a high as the inspectorate. We're in the news where we closed down about four factories in the Fort Peck area in Gauteng.
we were working with the Hawks, got intelligence from the Hawks. All of the those factories, without exception, the owners are Chinese, people of Chinese origin, and a few Chinese that have been naturalized South Africans. But what was the same pattern is that those factories, about three of them, 100% of the employees were coming from Malawi, and none of them documented. So in one factory, actually, the workers were locked in. They have lunch there, they sleep there, they buy there, there's a small tuck shop, so they buy from the employer and so on. I mean, there were one or two that were injured, taken to the doctor once, one had their fingers chopped, taken to the doctor once and never taken back. So the conditions were extremely bad. So as I'm talking to you, all those, the owners are in custody. Actually, the first group appeared in court last week where we also presented our case. So our view is that get hold of those few factories, make an example out of them, and it will act as a deterrent to those that you may not be able to reach. So work quite very closely with the Hawks because they've got that timely information. With regards to the Justice Department and the Master Court being closed, you know, what gives us a headache more than that is that our cases don't get prioritized in the courts. I mean, besides the fact that there is already a backlog in the courts, but then they don't prioritize our cases. I mean, if you go to the magistrate court, it's not seen as an urgent matter. So it gets pushed, and so those are some of the challenges that we're sitting with, besides the fact that we don't have enough of those courts and enough capacity to deal with. So we do have our cases sitting in the courts for quite a while. Fortunately, we refer about just under 10% of our cases, because the majority of the employers comply after the notices have been issued. And then on the issue of regulation of foreign nationals, the bill, Mr. Mutua will talk to that because it's mostly in his domain. And then there was a question on how do we ensure anonymity and make sure that the complainants remain anonymous and therefore the limited chances of victimization. We know these things, and when a person complains to us, we may know the identity, but when we go to a workplace, we don't disclose any of that information. So we go in there. Actually, we got to choose who we want to interview also in a workplace. So it's not like the employer will get, because sometimes some of the employers have got their own people. So when you ask to speak to workers, they'll give you those workers that they know will tell you what you want to hear. And we've also learned that some employers are scared to talk in front of their employer. So we have a way of gathering information without exposing where we get our source from. And then with regards to the Chinese community, the malls and so on, we had last year and the year before, we had a lot of places in and around. It varies in those malls. Some are more compliant than others. If I was to use Western Cape here as an example, we found very good practice. The community, the Chinese community in the Western Cape is, they're a joy to work with. We actually had a seminar where we had about 200 employers. Even the ambassador was part of the group that was there. And none of the workplaces that we went to that they were employing, all of them were compliant with the national minimum wage and the conditions of. When we found areas of challenge, they were willing to kind of help. So it differs from area to area. Like you find in some provinces, it's worse than others. And you spoke about the SPA group. You go to the SPA group in the Northern GP. I mean, most of them employ almost 100% foreign nationals.
and you find basic conditions of employment, they flout everything that is there to be flouted. And there are actually a few group of spas. One group of spa that was closed down by the spa conglomerate itself, because we also work with the spa conglomerate where when a spa owner is a franchise, it's a known and continuous perpetrator, they then would rather take the license away from you. So we had instances where we work with them and they're also willing to, so that we approach these things from different angles. And yes, again, you'll find group of spas that are quite excellent in the way they do things. So while you find very bad workplaces, there are also very, very good ones. With regards to this, the role of the CPOs in place and whether we have thoughts about emulating that model, our view is that unions should really be playing that part. Because remember, those are our ears and eyes on the ground. And the first port of call with regards to empowering workers and also sensitizing us to areas that are problematic. With regards to skilling, the inspector's gap, and you brought it up. You know, when it comes to just a practical example, the Home Affairs, and testing the validity of, I don't know if you remember the issue around the trucks that were being banned in KZN. We got into that space, and you find here the truck driver, they've got a license, they've got these papers. These foreign papers, asylum, yes, and so on. For you to test whether that is valid or not, you need, you must have, your asylum permits and so on. You need access to the system. Because on paper, it will look legitimate. And unless you test it on the system itself. So that's where the difficulty comes in. And but with regards to other areas of empowering, like we work with the NPA on investigation, because they're specialists in that area, how to investigate and so on, best practice from police themselves and so on. So we do collaborate. I hope that I've covered the question.
Yes, you have. Did I add something, sir?
No, there was a point around which the Honorable Chairperson raised around integrated inspection. We must put on record that there was a process that was initiated at some stage to try and look at the possible integration of the ODINWA, which is within health, the mining inspection, and the Department of Labor Inspectors, and to come up with one bill and the housing of the entire inspectorate in one of the departments. Now, within the mining sector, the employers protected that space, and that draft bill never saw the light of the day. Although within health, because they are sitting with major problems of their own, they were willing to relinquish that function and to also give the ODINWA function to the compensation fund to run with them. There's this question that keeps on coming on the review. Now, we did conduct extensive reviews of our labor laws based on the issues that were identified to be problematic. Those issues are the ones that led to a series of amendments that were brought in the fifth administration. The issues that we have now looked at, honorable members will remember that there was a job summit last year. Even in the job summit, the social partners raised a number of issues, and we are very sensitive to these issues because whenever they raise an issue that relates to the labor laws, immediately would commission a research to look at
the problems that they were raising. I mean, the most common ones that came in the fifth administration was this issue around the violent nature of the strikes and the fact that they are not managed, and the amendments resulted in this balloting and the procedures that the unions must follow, where you still find resistance in terms of implementation. The philosophical ones which we continue to get around the right to hire and fire, and the whole question of bargaining councils not to exist, and the extension of bargaining rights agreements to non-parties. These are the common ones that are on the current. But honorable members will know that if you go to any of the employer organizations, they will tell you that no, we have never raised, WUSA has never raised those issues, because they are part of the ILO, they are part of NEDLAC, and they know the importance within government. Our own treasury colleagues raised the issue, and we posed a question. The minister said to them, do you want an environment where every government department, because the biggest unions that we have now as we speak, whether you go to SAFTU, COSATU, FEDUSA, are the public sector unions as compared to unions in the other sector. Now, can you imagine, honorable members, if every government department was to bargain on its own with every department when we all get an allocation from the central place? It will be impossible. Even DPSA will find it very difficult. Currently, we have the entire public service in one public services bargaining forum. The other one is the police, the uniformed, and the teachers. That's where you have the three bargaining councils. But even then, the management of the three in the public service sector, it is very difficult, but at least you have a central place where conditions of employment can be negotiated. Now, on the extension of bargaining agreements to non-parties, the issue is simple. Those that have come together within the industry and have agreed to bargain, they are simply saying, if we are the majority and we have agreed on certain rights and basic conditions to be implemented within the sector, and we have approached the minister to gazette those, even though you may not be a member, you should be bound by those rights. And that has been a general principle that both employers in the bargaining council and the trade unions within the bargaining council has actually supported. And the example that Ms. Mueller was giving on the banning of trucks resulted precisely because some employers chose not to abide by the agreements that were extended by the bargaining council, and then it then had an unnecessary or unfortunate situation where they then found each other in the street, banning of trucks with cargo and all that. And the bargaining council said, look, you can't draw us to this because these people have refused to abide by the bargaining council. So even that debate around the rigidity, I thought that Mr. Vigil Seafield tried to do that. We are trying to locate where exactly is it coming from, because the employers in this country have not, on public platforms or recognized forums, raised that issue. Thank you.
Just a follow-up. The regulations that I was referring to, let me make an example about Rwanda. And I think Tanzania have also said that. If I go there as a company saying I'm in construction, I say, and then I've won the tender to build that road, I am then given clear that fine, But 70% of people that are to work here must be local. And in the remaining percent, you are to take people whom we don't have skills in that particular country. That's what I was really referring to, because at the end, I mean, for crying out loud, in the hospitality industry, everybody there, you know for a fact, majority of them is foreign nationals. But we were once told early when we came in this committee that there's an act which was there from before 1994, which allowed the previous regime to take a conscious decision that everybody's going to be in the hospitality industry, especially the chefs, are to be people that are coming from outside the country, Malawians, the Zimbabweans, and whatever. So the for me, the regulation by the, that's why I'm saying, as members, private members, Bill, or the department, or the committee, we can come up with that there must be that regulation. Basically, Chair, it was more on that. My apology if I've made a confusion.
No, thank you. We thought that when I do the public employment services, because the whole question of the regulation, including the issues you are raising, Honorable Chairperson, the policy on migration, I will explain all the things that we are doing, including with Home Affairs and the amendment to the Immigration Act. So I didn't want to touch on them because it's a whole range of issues.
Thanks, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, let me call upon Prof. Singh to deal with the Executive Versus Advisory Board. We just need to accommodate here because of the flight challenges. So, ma'am, are you going to be working from where you are? Sure. The nice thing with democracy is that people have the right to answer for themselves.
Can she come and sit closer to us? Don't be afraid of us. We are not in a portfolio committee. We won't show you the door. Why not? Come closer, Prof.
Yes. Looks like she's ready to run away.
Yeah, that's why I put
it. Can we put up the presentation? Prof, over to you.
Chair, appreciate you accommodating me. Good afternoon, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. I'm just going to give you a rundown of Executive Board versus Advisory Board. And when I was given this brief, it was just a broad, high-level distinction between these two boards, without actually making it specific to the Department of Employment and Labor. So from the broad principles, we could actually apply the specifics to our boards. Executive Board and Advisory Board, appear to be similar, but actually are very different. Both boards have a chair, they have members, they're appointed in terms of legislation, They have regular meetings, they have a constitution, and they have direct access to the minister. However, both boards are different in terms of governance, accountability, and power. When it comes to executive board, are we waiting for the presentation? Can continue, okay. When it comes to executive boards, we find that the aspect of corporate governance is critical, it's important, it's very applicable. And what do we mean by corporate governance? Right? But corporate governance embodies systems, processes in terms of which, and I sort of talk about public entities or state-owned entities, so these processes and systems direct, control, and in terms of which these public entities, you know, account. So very important, corporate governance is institutionalized by the King Report and the King King Report 4 currently. And although this is aligned, the King Report and its code is aligned to the Companies Act, it is very relevant to state-owned or public entities. In fact, the Companies Act includes in its definition as a company state-owned entities. So when we look at the Companies Act and corporate governance principles, it's very applicable to executive boards. So, you know, with an executive board the executive board therefore constitutes fundamental base for the application of corporate governance principles. So the role of the executive board, very succinctly, is to hold absolute responsibility for the performance of a public entity. It retains control of the public entity. It ensures that the public entity complies with all laws, regulations, and policies. It formulates, monitors, review corporate strategies, major plans of action, risk policies, annual budgets, etc. So it's very much in control of a public or state-owned entity. Next slide. So the mission of an executive board is therefore then to actually fulfill the mandate of a public entity in accordance with the strategic objectives of government, of course. So the executive board is ultimately accountable for the performance of the public entity, and accountable to the minister, and failing which it is accountable and liable. You know, so those are the importance of it being applicable in terms of the corporate governance principles. The members of an executive board, you know, who are appointed by the minister as well, have decision-making powers, and these members, act on behalf of the public entity and run the day-to-day affairs of the public entity. We find that the board members carry a full responsibility in terms of the Public Finance Management Act, which is, you know, quite critical in our environment, in the sense that, you know, the functions of, for example, an accounting officer, an accounting authority, is similar to what the board would hold in terms of the Public Finance Management Act. For example, it must ensure effective, efficient, transparent systems that are in place in terms of the operational risk management, financial controls. It has to ensure that there is a system of internal audit, appropriate procurement systems. It collects all revenue due to the public entity. It has to ensure that or prevent irregular, fruitless, and wasteful expenditure. Manages the working capital of the public entity, and safeguarding of assets. So many of these is aligned to what a role and function of a director of an accounting officer would be. So the executive board also has it could take disciplinary steps against any employer who contravenes the Public Finance Management Act or commits an act which undermines the financial management of the internal controls of the public entity, or makes or permits irregular, fruitless or wasteful expenditure. So, you know, it has a whole lot of, you know, functions and roles and responsibilities in terms of the Public Finance Management Act. With regard to committees, since the executive board cannot, you know, carry out all the functions effectively of an executive board, it does, you know, appoint committees to assist in order to implement and supervise the performance of the functions of the executive board. Various committees are set up. For example, you have the audit committees, the executive committees, human resource committees, the remuneration committee, a risk management committee, and a procurement committee. So these committees, specific to what it does, assist the executive board in effecting its functions. There is a CEO appointed. The minister appoints a CEO whose role is separate from that of a chairperson. And the role focuses mainly on the operations of the public entity, ensuring that the public entity is run efficiently and effectively in accordance with the strategic decisions of the executive board. The chairperson, the minister appoints chairperson who is the head of the executive board, and the chair's roles and responsibilities are different from that of the CEO. A chair's responsibilities are, amongst others, you know, it ensures that the board members are fully informed of any business decision, ensures that the executive directors play an executive management role and participates fully in the operation and governance of the public entity. It places relevant matters on the agenda in terms of its priority, and ensures that the executive board at all times, you know, understand the nature and extent of its responsibilities. So the executive board, as representative of the public or state-owned entity, is entrusted to fulfill its obligations and functions of the public entity. It does, for example, receive funds on behalf of the public entity, opens bank accounts, it appoints agents to represent it, for example, accountants, attorneys, counsels, and other professional persons. It litigates for various issues and defends litigation against it. It formulates policies and procedures, etc. So, you know, it does, in fact, you know, takes hold of the public entity in its entirety. Then we go on to advisory boards, and we find that the advisory board, as the name suggests, is very advisory in nature, and provides the minister with advice. That is essentially what a advisory board does. The advisory board, unlike the executive board, has no legal obligation for advice. It is not legally binding, and is not accountable for the advice that it provides. However, in providing advice, it is in the King 4 report, for example, we call it the business judgment rule, where in giving advice, due care, diligence, and reasonableness must be taken into account. You know, so you can't just give any advice. You know, you must take into account, you know, or give advice diligently. Mainly the advisory board adds experience to a public entity. It draws skills, experience, and knowledge from all the advisors that are, you know, that make up the advisory board, and this is essentially to enhance the effective running of the entity, you know, in giving good advice. The members of the advisory board are also appointed by the minister for a term, and the minister may, of course, also terminate these appointments. The functions of an advisory board is, as I said, to advise the minister on matters of various policies relating to, for example, a particular piece of legislation with regard to the public entity. For example, if you look at one of our boards, the so-called advisory board to the UIF, for example, you know, it could advise that public entity with regard to insurance, unemployment insurance policies arising out of the application of the Act, policies for minimizing unemployment, creation of certain schemes, and recommendations to the minister on changes to legislation. So these are the advisors specific to a particular piece of legislation that an advisory board could give advice. The chairperson of the advisory board is also appointed by the minister and who presides over the meetings of the board. There are committees that are also appointed in terms of, you know, the advisory board setup, because, you know, also to assist the advisory board so that it could perform its functions effectively. And each committee will have the necessary expertise. The committees, you know, they will provide a report to the advisory board, who will work on the report, deliberate on the report, and add sufficient material if necessary, and then, you know, provide that report to the minister. So essentially what we are saying is that we have two boards, the executive board and an advisory board. And in terms of an executive board, it is very accountable for its advice or whatever, you know, it does for that particular entity. It is legally bound, it is accountable. And whereas an advisory board, on the other hand, if it gives it, you know, advice, it is not legally binding, and that is essentially the distinction between an advisory board and an executive board. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Sounds fairly straightforward, but let's give an opportunity for any clarity seeking questions. There's none. I suspect they also don't want you to miss your flight. But that's not the correct criteria. But thank you very much for the presentation. Much appreciated. Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, on that note, let's break for lunch. It's now 1:10. We will start promptly at 1:45. As in promptly. So I'll be here.